So basically, if we can start with your of your memory of when you first found out about the disaster, what happened?
Yes. Well, thinking about it, I think we probably heard about it on the news, didn't we? That an oil tanker had run aground in the mouth of the Milford Haven estuary. And I thought, crumbs, that's just down the road. So I was working at the time, so on my first day off, we jumped in the car and drove down there. And I can remember seeing it stuck on the mid-channel rocks, sort of heaving up and down. One thing that particularly sticks in my mind is that as a wave went over the ship was virtually underwater. As the wave went over, so you could see a fountain of oil forced up and squirting out all over the place, and a tremendous amount of oil came out. And I think the wind was northerly, which pushed the oil out to sea. But if the wind was where it usually is from the southwest, it would have pushed the oil right up the Milford Haven estuary, and it could have easily reached Halford West and Blackpool Mill. So I don't know which was the worst, because the oil was washed out to sea and it went all the way up the coast. And I can remember a week or so later, we went to Tenby and we saw the harbour was a thick layer of slowly heaving muck, you know, can't think of any other description. And the South Beach was like a tarred road, and they were trying desperately to clear it, but the wheels of the trailers that they were carrying the stuff away in was carrying the mud up the road, and the road was a sort of sheen of dirty, smelly, stinking oil. And the shops had got lots of cardboard so that people coming off the street into the shop, at least some of the oil went off their shoes on this cardboard rather than spoiled the carpet. So, horrible business. But fortunately, coming on, you know, 20 years later, I think Mother Nature's more or less back to normal. Things seem to be normal. You see the little creatures in the rock pools swimming about, but I think some creatures have come back more quickly than others. But there are some species that are very slow. But, I'm not a marine biologist, but you look at things, oh, that's familiar. I've seen that before. Oh, I know what that is, I think. But you know, some have recovered, and others are a little more behind, as it were. But anyway, it's a nasty old business all round.
When they were doing the cleanup, who was involved in that then? Did you see people locally around here?
Well, virtually everybody that was out at work was given a suit of oilskins, a pair of thick gloves, either a brush or a spade or something, and a bag, and they were literally shoveling this stuff up and putting it into bags and buckets and barrels. And I can remember they had a couple of aircraft. I think they were the old DC-3s flying over, low over the water, and dropping chemicals on this heaving mass on the sea to break it up. I think it was called Gamelin. That was supposed to break up the floating stuff, but the stuff that had been washed ashore, it was setting and it was making a horrible mess. Trouble is, the birds were washed in. Ruth Griffiths told me that she was involved with that to a degree. They'd catch the birds and clean the oil off their feathers, but the trouble was it was ingested, so they had oil inside, and cleaning the feathers, it meant that the feathers weren't waterproof anymore. So if you put the poor thing in the water, it would sink. You know, I mean, a seagull that can't swim, it had all sorts of impact on things.
So, was there anybody telling people how to do it properly?
Well, I think it was very much a sort of ad hoc thing, sort of spur of the moment. It was a sort of air of desperation. Let's get at this. So, it's one of those things that nobody had thought of before, so they had to do things almost on the hoof, as it were, to try and mobilize people, find the cleanup gear, get all these. I think there were two airplanes to get them to come to drop the chemicals, buy the chemicals. So it was quite a logistical exercise because it wasn't just around Angle, as they say, it was in Tenby and all the little beaches all the way along the coast. And a couple of people I knew were involved in it, and they did have health problems afterwards, you know, they had skin problems, but.
Do you think it had, they had a long-term health problem afterwards, or do you think it's
I don't think so, no.
just a, like a local?
I think it was one-off thing, you know, constant breathing in stinking fumes and oil on your hands all the time, and I think it was it affected the skin because even though you had gloves and oil skins, you know, you'd get a bit of oil in between where the glove ends and the jacket starts, you know, you're reaching out for something and you get oil on there. And if you've got two dirty hands, you know, you take one glove off, but now I've got a clean hand to get the dirty glove off. So it's never easy. But I can remember also there were some oyster farms upriver. There was one, a big one in the Caro River, and all the chemicals they used to disperse the oil got in the food chain, and it damaged the oyster farms and literally stopped his business. But that was all right. Well,
Do you
I
think
once it
it recovered afterwards, or?
no, it
Oh,
never.
no.
Because it simply destroyed his oyster farm, but he had other businesses, so I'm sure he lost a lot of money because it was quite a huge investment.
Do you
It
think he
was
got compensation?
probably because I know that they were paying out compensation to yacht owners where there was a sort of ring of oil around the yacht at waterline, so he probably did.
Because I know there was a fishing ban, wasn't there?
That's right, yeah. Well, anything like shellfish and fish like that, but I think after a few years that started to pick up a bit. But, I mean, it was 20 years ago, wasn't it?
And what was your initial feeling with them when you saw the oil for the first time?
Well, horror, disgust, and think, oh, crumbs, why this? Why now? How on earth did they allow this to happen? You know, and until you saw it, you didn't realize the enormity of it. And sort of being involved with the water and fishing and sailing and things, you know, I could see the implications that were going to come, you know, the damage to wildlife and fish stocks and seaweed and even tiny little shrimps in the rock pools, you know, that.
So how long do you think it took to before you could see a real change?
Well, I think after about a year it started to pick up again, and then as the years went on and a few Atlantic gales stirring things up and dislodging the oil and smashing it up, because I mean on our cliffs there are places where you just couldn't get at it, you know, but nature smashed it up, and I don't know what happened to it, but I think from what I can see, well, it's all gone now, but certainly after about 2 or 3 years, you could see things starting to come back to some semblance of normality.
I've been thinking about when people would actually go back in the water.
That's a bit like asking how long's a piece of string, you know. I mean, you looked at the water, you think, yeah, I'm not going in that, you know. Instead of a nice ripple and little breeze generated wavelets, you know, you just saw this big sluggish lump, you know, and it was, I won't say it's pulsing, but the wave would come in and the oil would flatten it down. I mean, they say pour oil on troubled waters, don't they? And you could just see this thing heaving. And the boats in Tenby Harbour were sort of gently tugging at their moorings, and you'd see rope covered in oil, you know. And you think, well, the sailor goes down there to get his boat out, and straight away there's oil in his hand. But was there any point going out? I mean, I doubt if they could start the engines even. without doing serious damage to something. So, I mean, it probably hit their livelihoods. And so
Must have been a hell of a smell.
it was, it was a sort of sickly, sweet smell. It's because crude oil is very different to petrol. You know, it's a sickly, it sort of catches in your throat. You know, it's horrible stuff.
And from what I can gather, they took quite a long time to get it off the rocks.
Yes,
So.
they did. Because the Pembrokeshire coastline's quite long, as you know. It took a lot of men, a lot of time, but there are lots of places they just couldn't reach, you know. And they relied on a couple of winters with Atlantic gales to literally break the oil up. And I don't know what happened to it when it broke up, but it could well have gone into the food chain like this modern hoo-ha about microbeads, you know. So I would be very surprised if it didn't get into the food chain one way or another.
Yeah. So, what lessons do you think we might have learnt 20 years on?
Well, do we ever learn?
Good question.
Sorry if I'm a bit of a cynic, but I think
It is a valid question, though,
that's
isn't
it.
it?
Yeah, well, the lesson to learn is the ship, the Sea Empress, came in and something went very, very wrong on the approach. And I don't know the ins and outs of it, but there was somebody lost concentration or something, and there was a bit of a mixture and conflicting commands right at the most awkward moment, and she ran aground. I think the lesson that they've learned now is that when a big tanker comes in, to have tugs close by to escort it in, and if there is trouble, they get a line on it and bring it in. Because although you look at from Angle to St Anne's, it looks tremendously wide. But what you don't realise, smack in the middle, there's a mountain. And it's not just a nice round mountain, they're real jagged peaks sticking up. And the channel round this mountain is extremely narrow. There's a whole string of buoys, you know. Being a sailor, you can think, right, now I've got to go round that buoy, round that one, round that one, round that one, round the pole, and then out. But if you miss that, there has been talk about double-skinned tankers where you have an outer skin and then a space and another skin. But those would be fine if you landed on a flat beach. But these are great jagged pinnacles where the ship came on it. The pinnacle went through one hull and it would have gone through the second one as well. And of course, once it's there, it's stuck. And they tried to pull it off with tugs, and this was sort of ripping the bottom and letting even more oil out. So it's like everything else at sea. One little mishap suddenly cascades into a whole string of mishaps. And once something starts going wrong, it's an awful job to put it right. I've noticed of late that they don't bring such big tankers in anymore. The thing now is the big gas tankers. They look like floating garden sheds. I mean, when you see one, you think, yuck, horrible, ugly-looking ship. You know, they don't look graceful like the sailing ships of the 19th century, but great floating garden sheds. Perhaps I'm being a bit bit unsympathetic, but they don't look graceful. But there again, the tugs are out there, and the tugs sort of escort them in, and they get them into the big berth by what used to be Esso. They put them in there. So
So are there tankers waiting to come in then? Because
well, not really. Well, they fill up wherever they are, wherever they're getting the natural gas from, and they come. I think if the market's right, they do park them somewhere. Sometimes you can see several oil tankers in St Bride's Bay. Now, whether they're full, waiting for the market to change a bit so they can make more money for the cargo, or whether they just haven't got a cargo for them to go and collect. So it's a sort of bit of a grey area, but certainly the ships, when they come in, the port authority knows it's coming, and they've got a tracking device. They can tap into their computer, the ship's name, and even if it's far out in the Atlantic, they know exactly where it is, and you can track it hour by hour as it comes in. And then, because they need to know when it arrives here, because they need to send the pilot out on the tugs to escort it in and get through this narrow little channel. I don't know if you've ever seen the Irish ferry go out. If it go
Yeah.
out through Angle, it seems to hug the rocks underneath the St Anne's Light, but it has to because this great mid-channel rock is sticking up there. It extends from Thorn Island right out to the pole. Now, the pole is, it's a lighthouse, but it's like a stick just sticking up. But underneath it, there's only 10 feet of water. You think, all that way out, only 10 feet of water. But of course, the mountain just drops off. So you've got to be very
So it's
careful.
really sheer
That's
underneath.
right, yes. I mean, if you're fishing there with the weight, you can feel your weight, and all of a sudden, away he goes down the weight. But then you look at the chart, you can pick out the depths on the chart. And going back to the tanker when it comes in, the pilot's on the bridge, well out to sea, and as you approach, just by Mill Bay, there are three tall concrete posts sticking up. And then about a mile further out, there's one. And what the pilot has to do, he's coming in, he sees these three, and he's got to bring the one in line with the middle one like that. And that tells him he's right in the middle of the channel. And then he gets just past, well, into the entrance of Dale, and he's got to do a sharp turn, and he picks up some other more leading lights. So it's, but of course, it sounds easy to talk about it, but actually doing it when it's blowing and it's dark and there's rain and fog and you think, where are they? Is that it? Is that it? Is that it? And,
Do you think it could happen again?
well, I hope it won't, but human nature being what it is, it might well, I hope it won't, but because that's not the first tanker that's gone down there. There was one run aground on Great Castle Head. Boy, that it about the 1960s. It had come through the channel and it had turned to come up the Haven and something happened and the wind blew it straight into Great Castle Head and it was stuck there for a bit. So it's this isn't the first tanker that's come to grief. But fortunately, that one didn't spill a lot of oil. So things do tend to repeat themselves, don't they? But
Let's hope not.
well, fingers crossed.
Yeah. And do you remember the kind of sense of community where people rallying round and
I think so, yeah. I wasn't terrible because it hit Angle mostly, and I think a lot of people there, the Angle villagers, were helping these unfortunates trying to clear the rubbish up, that I wasn't too, I mean, incautious, and it didn't affect us very much. But I think there was a lot of the old wartime spirit, trying to get this problem solving and everybody grumbling about the powers that be, and they ought to be more careful and all that.
What were you doing at the time then?
Well, I was working at the time. I used to be a building inspector for the Pembrokeshire County Council, so there we are. And
Because the council provided a lot of
they did,
workers,
yeah,
didn't
that's
they?
right. Probably their environmental health department there, and of course them and the Port Authority, they pulled together to do something about it,
And obviously, it was all over the news.
That's right there.
I mean, I wasn't here at the time, I was away at college, so I don't really remember much about it.
No, it's
20 years ago.
that's right. Yeah, it only seems like yesterday, isn't it? Trouble is, at our age, you can remember things that happened a long time ago, and yet, what did I do yesterday? Sort of thing. But there we are. But life is good on the whole. But, I think a lot of people learned lessons, but the trouble is, 20 years have passed, and a little bit of complacency creeps in, and, oh, we haven't had an accident for 20 years, and all of a sudden, oh dear. But I
and
hope
it's still
it won't happen.
About responsibility, isn't it?
Whose responsibility is it? That's right. I would like to think that the signal station in Milford, you know, where the harbour master has his little den, they're very much on the ball now. So, and they've got quite, I think they've got about four or more big tugs that are based in the haven. So they can go out to meet the ship coming in. So hopefully it won't happen again. It would be awful if it did, because this is a lovely county, but I feel it's not really appreciated. For example, if this was on the south coast of England, there'd be more boats than water.
Yes.
And things would happen. But to be honest, I'm glad it's like this, because I've got a bit of elbow room when I go out in the boat.
But, yeah, you're right, it would be...
Well, it money would creep in. They'd charge us to launch the boat. And I mean, fees here are bad enough, because the Crown Commissioners, if you put a mooring down, the Crown Commissioner would charge you rent for the little bit of seabed underneath your mooring block. And then you've got to pay the Port Authority for the licence and the number of the mooring. And of course, you've got to pay to have your yacht lifted in and lifted out at the end of the season. So I used to have quite a big yacht, and so I got involved in that firsthand. But my brain tells me I'm a teenager, but my knees say, no, don't be silly, you know, creaking a bit. So I sold the yacht because it was getting a bit heavy for me. So I'm quite happy pottering about in that, you know. And with the West Wales Maritime, they've got a lot of boats, so we do a lot of boating with them. So it's we're not missing out, but it is getting expensive. And I feel if we were on the south coast, they would be charging me exorbitant rates to just launch the dinghy. Whereas at the moment, I just go down the beach and push it in the water, and away we go.
So you feel that they would be, they're much more protective of their water and of their territory and their...
Yeah, well, I think money would come into it. They would be protective of the environment, because as long as the environment is good, people would want to sail, and they'd be able to get charge them for the privilege of mooring and sailing and launching tenders and all the rest of it. I think, in all honesty, there hasn't been a lot of pollution lately, you know. I've been wandering about on the beaches, Kilpaison, the beach down here at Cosheson, and the water's quite pleasant, you know, and you see occasional fish and a lot of people sailing, and things seem reasonably good. Because, I mean, even when I was a small boy, we used to go and light a fire and find all these balls of oil, you know, and bung the balls of oil into a fire to... And you have this great column of black smoke going up, but you don't see that anymore. No, thank goodness. You know. Yes, I mean, what we don't know about is the big imponderable is the exhausts of engines, and you don't know quite what they're pumping into the water. And of course, this recent microbeads thing. So, wonder sometimes what we're doing to this planet.
So going back to Sea Empress, any more, anything else you want to, that you've just can remember or want to add?
I don't think so offhand. I think I've rabbited on long enough, but I can't remember anything more. But as I said, when you rang me, I Googled it, and there's quite a lot of photographs on Google, and that's where I remember the date from, 1996. So.
Okay. Thank you very much.
That's okay.